listen to her all day long, Billie Holiday. This year it marks her 100th anniversary of her birth. And here in Baltimore, Baltimore claims in many places, we claim here in Baltimore City, there is a new exhibit called Billie Holiday, A Life in Music, curated by Stuart Hudgens over at the UB Blake Jazz Center. And Stuart joins us in the studio. Good to see you, Stuart. How are you?
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you here. 410-319-8888 is the number to join this conversation. Your reflections on Billie Holiday and more. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can email us, as I said. I mean, you can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, but 410-319-8888. So this exhibit, we've been battling back and forth by email on this exhibit since you started this. Mm-hmm. So talk a bit about what you did here.
Sure. Well, Billie Holiday, of course, we claim her in Baltimore. She was born in Philadelphia, but she was raised in Baltimore. And we're celebrating her 100th, her centennial year. Very important milestone. Billie Holiday was a great vocalist. She was an influential vocalist, but she was a musician. And a lot of her development as an artist began in Baltimore. So the exhibit has part of its focus deals with the early years, her Baltimore years. Those are the years that most writers and historians get wrong.
What do you mean they get wrong?
Well, the dates, the facts, basically, up until 1956 when her book came out, Lady Sings the Blues, this was pretty much the only real record of her life story. Mm-hmm. And as we know, it was ghostwritten. Much of the information was exaggerated, wasn't true. Unfortunately, this was the only record up until 1971, 72, when Linda Kuehl came to Baltimore. She was a biographer and a friend of members of Billie Holiday's family. She came here with a recorder, and she recorded some of the family members, friends, and others who ran with Billie in those early days when she was 13, 12, singing in speakeasies, whiskey houses. And we were able to take some of that information that was left and gathered in the interviews and find places that were significant in her life, like the whiskey house. Ethel Moore had a place at the bottom of the point, it was called. It was the Black Red Light District.
Right. Pennsylvania Avenue?
Bond Street.
Bond Street.
Caroline. Dallas was right there. East Baltimore.
East Side, right.
East Side, which is primarily where she grew up. And some of the buildings still exist. We've taken photographs of her homes on South Durham Street.
What's there now? Are they empty houses or people live there, actually?
No, actually, she lived in two houses on South Durham Street, 217 and 219, at different times over the period of a year. And both of those houses still exist. The Whiskey House is on a gentrified block, beautiful house. The second floor was where she first heard the Victrola recordings of Louis Armstrong and Bessie Smith, who she admired. Mm-hmm. And her Baltimore years really were significant because they prepared her for New York. And fortunately, the record now shows that when she would go to the Whiskey House, her friends would convince her to sing a song or two. They'd get, you know, they'd smoke their 25-cent reefers, and that got the party started. And then they'd leave and go to an after-hours club. And when she got to the club, she would take the audience to the next after-hours club with her by just simply announcing that she was leaving.
How old was she then?
13 years old.
Wow.
This was East Baltimore. And late in 1928, early in 1929, she moved to New York. Her mother called for her. And then, of course, her professional career began in earnest.
It's an amazing story. I mean, we don't hear that story very much. We had a man on the show recently named Johann Hari. I don't know if you read his book, called Chasing the Scream. Mm-hmm. Have you read the book yet?
No, actually, I haven't.
It's an amazing story. It's one of the best stories on Billie Holiday I've ever read, mm-hmm. because it is about the war on drugs in America.
Yes.
And how, though, that they obsessed on Billie Holiday.
Yes.
And on destroying her and going after her.
Absolutely.
And it's an amazing, a horrible, horrible story, but an amazing story. It also showed the power of Billie Holiday and her internal fortitude.
Absolutely.
Despite her addictions, this powerful internal fortitude that she had to get through all of that.
Well, her recording of Strange Fruit, Time magazine in 1999 declared it the song of the century. And it was the song of an anti-lynching, well, it was an anti-lynching anthem,
right.
essentially.
Right.
She turned it into an anthem.
Right.
And she used to sing it night after night at Cafe Society. It was written by Abel Mirapol, who was a school teacher, a socialist. And they had a movement, an anti-lynching movement that was gaining strength throughout the country. And Billie Holiday, of course, considered herself a race woman, which meant that she was conscious of the black experience and what it meant to be African American in America, a woman in a man's field. And so she absolutely refused to not sing the song. J. Edgar Hoover and others first tuned into Billie Holiday when she began recording the song. Well, when she began singing the song, and as we know, she was harassed really until the day she died.
It's it makes me think with that song and how she stood up to people and refused not to sing that song. She demanded she would
sing
it, but they said, no, you can't. She sang it anyway. It's almost like Nina Simone, you know, carrying on that same tradition.
Yes.
In the 60s especially, and 70s, when she stood up for not just the civil rights movement, but for black revolution even more intensely than civil rights.
Well, you take artists like Billie Holiday, and as they develop their persona as artists and public speakers, singers, people that are in front of the public, you'll see really traces of their background, traces of where they actually came from. In her case, it was Baltimore.
Right.
Her Baltimore years were pivotal. She used to sing in auditions at the Star Theater on the East Side. She used to win some of these contests. she used to play stickball. She was kind of shuttled around from relative to relative because her mother was a nanny and a domestic worker who traveled while she worked. So she would get on a train and work in Philadelphia for a while, and Billie was under the care of her family, who loved her, but she moved throughout the East Side. And
right, she was shuttled back and forth.
Yes.
Let's take a second here before we talk about the exhibit itself and just hear a piece of her singing Strange Fruit.
Great.
Pastoral scene of the gallant sun, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden
just that's such a powerful song that the two of them did together.
Yes.
So the exhibit.
Yes.
I mean, it's
we've got rare photographs. Billie was shot by some of the greatest American photographers, people like Jean Millie, who developed a style for Life magazine of strobe photography. He had a studio that was large enough to bring jam sessions into play. And he made a film called Jam and the Blues, which was nominated for an Academy Award that featured Lester Young. So we include in this multimedia exhibit film footage, interviews. You're able to see, hear Billie Holiday talking about her music. You'll hear other artists talking about Billie Holiday. These are artists who knew her, played with her, were familiar with her. These firsthand accounts were very important in establishing that Billie Holiday was not just about her drug addiction. She wasn't just about the sad story. If pictures are worth a thousand words, going through the exhibit, you're able to see Billie Holiday with friends. You're able to see her interacting with her dog, Mister, and family members. And so the exhibit tries to establish a timeline that brings into context her Baltimore experience and then her New York and professional experience. So we've got a few surprises. There's this incredible animated short called Strange Fruit that was done by Neil Zapata. And it's only 3 minutes long, but it's powerful. And
when was this made?
It was made he lives in Hollywood. He actually, his day job is working for the major studios. But
Zapata, Z-A-P-A-T-A?
No, it's Zapata.
Zapata.
Yes. And we got to know each other over the years. I have a film collection, and one of the first films that I saw that featured Oscar Brown Jr., was done by Neil Zapata. And when I first saw that and acquired that, we began talking. Then he let it slip that he had made this film on Billie Holiday. And so we were able to secure it for the exhibit. So that's going to run on a loop. You're able to see that. We also have, of course, her music. Her music is heard throughout. As you're walking through the exhibit, you're able to get a sense of what all the fuss was all about. Why was Billie Holiday such an influential artist? I think you'll come away with a feeling that her life story was just complex, but it was rich, and you can see that she touched people, and the artists that we have, we've got. Some of Baltimore's very strong artists participated in the show. People like Jim Reed, who constructed the monument to Billie Holiday that's on Pennsylvania Avenue in Lafayette.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But we were able to talk Jim into contributing some of his sketches, his preliminary sketches that went into the making of that monument. So you'll see some of that. Also, Charles Louder, a Baltimore artist, contributed a great piece to the show. Ernest Shaw, you may recognize.
Right.
Yeah. I have some of my own pieces there. Tommy Roberts. I called Tommy 2 weeks ago, and within the same week, he had put together this beautiful piece, just this warm blue Billy. It's beautiful. Jerry Prettyman.
Oh, yeah.
You might recognize Bebe Matthews. I mean Williams, Bebe Williams, whose work is pretty well known, not only in Baltimore but throughout the country. So we've got different artists who have contributed because they were touched, moved, and wanted to share in the Billie Holiday celebration. And that's the kind of spirit that this centennial has brought.
How long will the exhibit be up?
It'll be up until the 26th, and we will actually have a closing on the 26th.
Oh, in September?
Of September,
oh,
yes.
That's soon.
It's soon. But in that closing, you'll get a chance to meet some of the artists. It's open from 1 until 3, and you can go through the exhibit, hear her music, see the images that describe her. Get a sense of why her importance as an artist has really touched even young people. Generations, new generations, appreciate the stand that she took, appreciate the her ability to go out on the road as a woman in a man's field. She worked with Artie Shaw, an all-white band, and her experiences.
That's an interesting relationship in itself.
Oh, yes.
Between Audie Shaw and,
oh, absolutely.
And Billie Holiday.
I mean, the stories of each of the big bands that she worked with, Count Basie. She had a chance to work with Lester Young and some of the great sidemen who are wonderfully depicted in the exhibit. So we've got these great shots of all these great artists. And you'll get a real sense of who she was and why she was important.
So I'm anxious about taking a step back for a moment.
Sure.
What moved you to do this in the first place?
Well,
I'm
a collector.
Yeah, I know.
And I collect and show the rare films of African-American musicians and composers. And the first film that I bought in 1972 featured Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington. It was called Symphony in Black. Billie was just 19 years old when she made it. And I just
is it dramatic. I'm not.
Oh, well, it is dramatic. It's a part of Duke Ellington's extended work, Rhapsody in Black, and he took pieces from that extended work and fashioned them into the themes that we see in Symphony in Black. It's only 10 minutes long, but what I found out later was that Billie Holiday's father, Clarence Holiday, who was a banjoist with Fletcher Henderson's orchestra, great musician, was one of the 10 musicians that Duke Ellington augmented his big band to make this film. So he needed 10 more musicians, and he knew that Billie and her father were rekindling a relationship in New York. Now that she was a professional artist, they were the best of friends. I mean, they really...
She and her father.
Became friends. He was largely missing during her Baltimore years. But when she came to New York, they established a new relationship. Duke Ellington, of course, being from Washington, who knew them both, helped to put them together. So the footage includes Clarence Holiday, Duke Ellington's big band, and Billie singing The Saddest Tale. So
is that in the exhibit?
That's in the exhibit. We're running some of this footage in a loop. So as you walk through the exhibit, pieces are available for you to see. The interviews are available for you to hear. And importantly, it's just all repeated. So as you walk through, you get a sense of what the multimedia experience of Billie Holiday.
So taking it back here, you're a very creative man, and you do have this incredible film collection. But going back, but something moved you to want to do this.
Yes.
What I mean to put it out there. I mean, we in Baltimore, I don't think we had a quote unquote major celebration citywide of Billie Holiday and her centennial.
Well, it just happens that because Billie was such an influential artist, I began listening out at the top of the year to find out what was going to happen nationwide in her name. And I thought that it was important that Baltimore, her hometown, just do a little more to actually lay out an exhibit in such a way that people get a sense of the timeline, the factual information that defined her as an artist, and that they can walk away understanding that not only was she complex, but that she was not a defeated woman. She was inspirational. And she inspired me. She inspired a lot of artists. The artists, the visual artists that I named, I mentioned Billie Holiday's name. Everybody had the same reaction. They dropped what they were doing, many of them, and created brand new pieces just for the exhibit. So
yeah,
it's that feeling.
It also shows that people who have loved Billie Holiday but also have respect for you and your work to come do this.
Yes, yes, and I appreciate it, and I really do. Jerry Prettyman and Bebe and some of these veteran Baltimore painters just coming together like they did is a tribute to Billie, and in her hometown. And I don't know if you realize this, but Diana Ross was in town just over the weekend And of course, she got her cinematic
Lady Sings the Blues.
Lady Sings the Blues. So we showed Lady Sings the Blues is a part of the loop. Not the whole film, obviously, but so you'll get a chance to see the fairy tale, as well as Billie's own recordings and in her own voice and in her own style.
When I think of Lady Sings the Blues and seeing that movie, by the way, folks, join us here. I'm sorry, 410-319-8888. If you've seen the exhibit, we want to hear your thoughts about the exhibit of Billie Holiday taking place now at UB Blake. Your thoughts on Billie Holiday, her place in our world, her place as a race woman, her places in our history of music and culture, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talkistinashow.org, 410-319-8888. I was thinking about Lady Sings the Blues, and if Louis McKay had only been the kind of person they showed in that movie, but he was like the exact opposite.
He was the technical advisor.
To that movie?
To that movie. That's why he was the star of the movie.
So he was whitewashed, so to speak, in the film.
Absolutely. Well, he was an enforcer. He was not a nice guy and in real life. And Linda Kuhl, when she did her interviews, interviewed Louis McKay. So some of the real stories about who these real players were have come to light through these interviews.
Well, in the book I was describing earlier, which I'm going to give you a copy of, Chasing the Scream by Johann Hari, amazing book, he shows in that book that McKay actually cooperated with the police.
Absolutely.
To take down Billie Holiday.
And he was not the first to do that. Joe Levi did the same thing in San Francisco. She was playing at the Uptown Club in San Francisco. The cops knocked on the door, knocked the door down, and found Billie trying to flush an opium pipe. The FBI files described the raid. People like Tallulah Bankhead and other luminaries kind of rose to the occasion, wrote J. Edgar Hoover and others. And kind of pleaded for Billie to walk free, and she was eventually released because it was proven that he was an informer. He was an informer who set her up in that hotel room, and the case was dismissed.
And others in Hollywood who were white and women who were heroin addicts who had addictions were treated with kind of kid gloves. Yeah. As compared to what they did to Billie Holiday.
Sure. Well, and I guess you know the story about as she was leaving us, she was in New York in a hospital in an oxygen tent, and a nurse discovered white powder under her nose, or that's what she claimed. And they literally arrested Billie Holiday and assigned two guards for her door. And they confiscated her comic books, and it's just a sad story. Literally, her friends thought that she was making a comeback, that she was going to walk out of there. But I think she probably died of a broken heart. I mean, it was just a tragedy how she was treated.
So the exhibit you're having is literally only open for a little bit less than 3 weeks.
Yes.
So, I was hoping it was going to go on a whole year.
Yeah. Well, you know, the UB Blake is doing a lot of things. And September is a big month, a very popular month. And we were happy to get the dates that we did. And through the Mark Steiner Show and other social media, we hope to get folks through who can just get a real good sense of what all the fuss was about.
No, I think that, I mean, it just showing the slides as you showed me, I've not seen the exhibit yet. I've been remiss in not getting down there. I want to see this exhibit. But the paintings you showed me and the slides of the paintings by the local artists is just phenomenal.
Yeah. Lauren Cornish did a...
Oh, Lauren Cornish did
piece
as well.
He did a piece... it's a collage in glass. It's a glass collage. We were also able to bring up the Romare Bearden piece that he dedicated to Baltimore. It's called Baltimore Uproar. It's at the Upton subway station. and it's a large mural. We were able to photograph it and bring it up to the surface, so that's a part of the exhibit as well. So those folks who will probably never get off the train at Upton will have a chance to see Romare Bearden, who Billy was his muse. I mean, in many pieces that he constructed, Billie Holiday was front and center. So, and a lot of people don't realize this, but he got his first professional start as an artist in Baltimore working for the Afro-American newspaper in 1935 under Carl Murphy.
Under Carl Murphy, wow.
And it's that kind of spirit, Carl Murphy, Lillie Mae Carroll Jackson, Thurgood Marshall, and others, behind the scenes were developing a strategy for defeating Jim Crow. The separate but equal laws. And Billie Holiday had to know, living in Harlem, what was going on with the ongoing civil rights movement, which was at its very beginning in these days. And when she refused to stop singing Strange Fruit, she made a statement. She made a statement that people all over the world respected. And she put her professional career on the line. No major artist had ever taken such a stand with their celebrity.
So this exhibit, we're going to go out with under us with a Love Man by Billie Holiday.
Great.
And this exhibit, Stuart Hutchins, always wonderful to have you in the studio. Great to see you. It's been too long since we've seen each other. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you.
Billie Holiday, A Life in Music, open September 6th. We'll close on September 26th.
1 to 3
on September 26th at the U.B. Blake National Jazz Institute and Cultural Center, part of a series of celebratory events making the centennial year of the great jazz vocalist Billie Holiday in her hometown, Baltimore. It runs through September
26th. 1 to 3.
More information is available at ubblake.org. So make sure you get there, and I'm looking forward to seeing it myself. Stuart, thank you so much for your
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
We'll be right back. First, don't go away. When we come back from break, this news break, we'll be talking to Carl Stokes, who wants to be the next mayor of Baltimore. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Just to call you now, got a moon above me, but no one to love me. Love a man, oh, where can you be? I've heard it said that the thrill of romance can be like a heavenly dream. I go to bed with a prayer that you'll make love to me. Strange as it seems, someday we'll meet, and you'll dry all my tears, then whisper sweet little things in my ears, hugging and a kissing. Oh, what we've been missing. Love a man, oh, where can you be?